this week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
What happened then? What is the union, what is the AFL-CIO, what does the UAW say about it now? Do they regret their roles? Do they want to talk about their roles? Is it going to be shrouded in secrecy? Why?
January 8th is the 33rd anniversary of the brutal attack on workers at a Ford assembly plant in Mexico.
Today we embark on a new campaign. We will be calling every progressive city council person who on their caucus is supposed to be working for this community, the most vulnerable population, those who are over 65 on Medicare, and those who are disabled, public servants. And we will call you and email you every day to remind you that we are here.
Hundreds of thousands of New York City retirees face a frontal attack on their health care benefits through privatization of their Medicare retirement.
It has nothing to do with ethnicity. They killed Congolese like they were flies. You see how people, you feel a mosquito and you just hit? That's exactly how they killed. It did not mean anything to them how they were killing the Congolese, as long as we can just wipe them out and get access. I mean, the mines exist. People used to live in those areas. Have we ever asked who was living where the mine was before? Did the mine just show up? No, there were villages where those mines were.
And we'll hear about the humanitarian crises in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. January 8th, 2023 is the 33rd anniversary of the brutal attack on Mexico Ford Cuautitlan assembly plant. A gang of 150 thugs were brought into the plant to attack the workers, and many were injured and one was killed. Later, it was learned that the attack was financed, organized, and supported by the U.S., CIA, and leadership of the AFL-CIO, which was taking money from the National Endowment for Democracy. The AFL-CIO today gets $75 million for its Solidarity Center. Frank Hammer, a retired United Auto Workers Local 909 president from Detroit, talks about this anniversary and what auto workers have to do this year as all auto contracts expire.
Month we are commemorating the anniversary.
January 8th of the attack on the Ford assembly plant, Mexico City.
By a group of thugs.
And the injury of workers and also the murder of a Ford assembly worker. And joining us is Frank Hammer, who's a retired member of the UAW and has been involved in international solidarity. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
And so, Frank, why don't you talk about why you think this event is important, what happened in Mexico City at the Ford assembly plant 33 years ago, and what it means to working people and auto workers particularly.
I look at especially auto workers. I am a GM worker. I was on the assembly line. I was in my local for 20 years. And I know that the pressures that get put on the union and auto workers in particular in the U.S. cannot be looked at absent the context of globally what the companies are doing. We can't be having walls between auto workers here and the example you're giving about auto workers in Mexico and in at Ford, Cuautitlan, who were striving and who were militant local union, who were striving to improve their conditions and their work life and their life as a whole, only to encounter the resistance of the Ford Motor Company, aided by the U.S. government and aided by the AFL-CIO in suppressing that. So long as we're not on the same page, hey, we have one common enemy, whether it be Ford, GM, we are all fighting for better lives, and we should be fighting together arm in arm rather than the federation of our rep federation, the AFL-CIO, collaborating with the Labor Federation in Mexico, which was real pro-company, anti-worker, to crush a strike. And that's why January 8th is so important, because a worker lost his life waging that fight for a better life at the hands of the company, at the hands of the union goons who ran their union undemocratically on behalf of the companies in Mexico.
And this struggle about getting the history of that, is it still relevant? There's a book has been written.
El Golpe, U.S. Labor, the CIA, and the Coup at Ford in Mexico, by Rob McKenzie.
About that struggle, and there's still an effort to open the book to workers here to know about that history. Rob McKenzie wrote that book. He spent a lot of time trying to get the information out. It was not well known at the time. Is that struggle still going on to get a story out about what happened in Mexico City in 1990?
Yeah, absolutely. And Rob, who I consider a personal friend, he was in the local union leadership roughly around the same time that I was. He was on staff in UAW roughly the same time that I was. So we have parallel careers. And I think that he's performed a very important service to the working class and especially to UAW members by going back and researching what occurred and what transpired into Ford Local in 1990. And the reason is because he was involved in a solidarity campaign at that time as a Ford worker. And when he retired, he didn't forget about them. He went back and said, I want to know what happened, and I want to be able to tell the world. And the interference for him telling that story came from the same FLCIO and the same UAW who were involved in that bad situation in 1990 where the workers' struggle was crushed and a worker was killed and other workers were injured. So he's provided a very valuable service to opening our eyes to seeing, well, what happened then? What is the union? What is the FLCIO? What does the UAW say about it now? Do they regret their roles? Do they want to talk about their roles? Is it going to be shrouded in secrecy? Why?
And this history, of course, the covered-up history of what happened to the Ford Workers' Assembly Plant, the attack financed by the U.S. government, CIA, and the AFL-CIO, part of the hidden history, really, of a working class in Mexico, working class in the United States. But also, we're coming up on February 11th, which is the anniversary of the Flint sit-down and the lessons of that for workers. Why is this history so important, and what happened on February 11th that is relevant to auto workers today?
Well, I think, generally speaking, if we don't know our own history, how do we pivot? How do we understand our role in the present moment if we don't look and see, well, what role did we play in the past and what's transpired in the past and what can we glean from the pioneers who built our labor movement? And are we on track or did we go run off the rail? I'm of the opinion that there's been a concerted effort to conceal working class history from U.S. workers and from auto workers in particular and from UAW members. And one of the ways that this is done is without really informing the UAW members about the heroic struggle by auto workers in the 30s and at GM, where they occupied three factories for 44 days in the dead of winter with the company cutting off the power, sending shooting tear gas, and sending the National Guard. This was an open class struggle, and the union movement of today is leery of talking about the roots, our working class roots of struggle that built our unions. And I think that faced with the circumstances that we are today, with only 6 or 7% of the private sector in the United States unionized, that it's high time to understand that labor movement is under severe attack, and that's why we need to return to our roots and understand how did our pioneers, how are our forefathers and foremothers combat the same companies that we're dealing with today under new circumstances.
And you're making an effort to have a commemoration on February 11th. What would you like to see other auto workers and other workers do to commemorate that date?
Most important of all, to really invest their time in learning that history. And what better way than to have a national assembly using the internet or through a Zoom to enable that kind of exposure and discussion so that when GM workers, for example, or Ford or Stellantis look ahead to the national negotiations that's coming down the pike. What's going to be our stance? What's going to be our posture? What is going to be our preparedness? What is going to be our understanding? And we're not going to have any of that without understanding the traditions of our working class struggle in history in the U.S., never mind abroad.
And NAFTA and USMCA has very much integrated the auto production and expanded the auto production in Mexico, so that really is an integral part of U.S. auto production. This solidarity that workers have been talking about between U.S. and Mexican workers, how is that should be affected as far as action by U.S. workers, action by Mexican workers with these auto companies? I mean, is the time for united strike action of U.S. and Mexican workers together? Is that time come?
Well, I think that certainly is the direction that we need to move in. And in fact, I just share a conversation I had with a GM worker who I've been knowing for a long time. And he said, boy, I hunger for the day when the Canadian auto workers, the U.S. auto workers, the Mexican auto workers could be all part of one union. And I thought it was really great coming from a rank and file worker and saying, this is what we need. So I think what's important is that there are moves currently via the AFL-CIO, via the Solidarity Center, the international arm of the AFL-CIO and of the U.S. government, that they're making moves to support union organizing in Mexico. So it becomes a complicated affair to understand, well, what is their role exactly? What are their motivations? What are they trying to accomplish? But as long as there are actions in solidarity with, for example, Mexican workers who want a contract or who are on strike, we should definitely support them and let them know that U.S. workers understand that our fate is connected to their fate and that we will fight alongside their struggles, all the while keeping an eye on, well, what are the motivations of the FLCIO, the U.S. government, et cetera, in doing, engaging in these kind of efforts.
That was UAW 909 President Frank Hammer, interviewed by Pacifica Steve Zeltzer. You can find out more about this incident by going to the video, $4 a day, no way, on YouTube.
Ya me gritaron mil veces que me regresé a mi tierra porque aquí no quepo yo.
Somos más americanos, los Tigres del Norte. Hundreds of thousands of New York City retirees face a frontal attack on their health care benefits through privatization of their Medicare retirement. There have already been protests against these attacks. Pacifica Steve Zeltzer has more.
Hey everyone, it's Marianne from the New York City Organization of Public Service Retirees. It seems as if the city council has lost its cotton picking mind, is definitively trying to force retirees into Medicare Advantage plans and take away everything that they've earned. We're a little shocked by this, Councilman De La Rosa. This makes absolutely no sense. You guys are being fooled. So then this continues. We're deeply concerned with the challenges in our healthcare program for municipal retirees and employees. Well, you should be. And you should be asking the MLC and the City of New York, why is it that the stabilization fund is having financial trouble? Because it's been misused. And it's not just last year or the year before or in 2014 when they allowed the teachers union in their contract to contract out $1 billion from the health stabilization fund to pay for raises. Why aren't you, City Council, Progressive Caucus, asking these questions? Today, we embark on a new campaign. We will be calling every progressive city council person who on their caucus is supposed to be working for this community, the most vulnerable population, those who are over 65 on Medicare, and those who are disabled, public servants. And we will call you and email you every day to remind you that we are here. If the unions want to negotiate away their future health care, let them do it. But you see, the one thing that you also are forgetting is that any change that you make today in this plan doesn't just affect us, it affects you. It affects you right now, and it affects your future. Because you are putting your healthcare plan in the hands of two unions in the MLC and the City of New York.
I've just been hearing from a retiree, New York City, who is talking about the threat that they're gonna be privatizing the Medicare and hundreds of thousands of New York City retirees and workers are threatened with this privatization of Medicare. And joining us is Carol Lang. She's a professor at Bronx Community College, a member of PSC in New York City, a member of AFT. Welcome to our show.
One of the things that's happened over all the years that I worked for New York City was that we were always promised that since our wages were so low, that essentially we would make it up in the end and that we would have not only Medicare, but in 1967, the city passed a law, a code, 12-126, that basically said that it would pay for our benefits. The benefits, Medicare pays up to 80%. The other 20%, we would have had to pay. So the city is picking up the bill. And in that way, supposedly, we're remunerated for all the crappy, you know, salary that we got for, you know, 50 years working for New York City. So people feel betrayed, essentially.
And the union officials apparently negotiated this in secret, the public city union officials. What happened with that?
Well, for 3 years, the MLC, the Municipal Labor Committee, ended up, let me step back for a second. The retirees, our health care is negotiated by the unions, even though we ourselves don't vote on any contract, because officially we're not, the retirees are not represented by the unions. But when it comes to health care, it's the MLC that negotiates our health care. And so for the last 3 years, the way that the city administration has managed to pay even the minuscule raises that they paid was because the union leadership promised that they would hand us over to the vultures of the city administration and eventually get rid of that 20%, that code that guarantees us, you know, that the extra 20% that we ourselves can't afford to pay. And this is all done in secret. People ended up finding out that this was going on a couple of years ago. So on one of the hottest days of the year, it was like 94 or something in New York, all of these gray-haired folks were out in front of City Hall, in front of UFT and DC 37, demonstrating that we were furious about the impending sellout. There are two major unions that are really weighing heavily in the MLC, and that's DC 37, which incorporates 125,000 workers from all walks of life, and the UFT. And so basically they're arguing that we're anti-union and that we're selfish and that this is a good plan and we should write to city council and say, get rid of the code. I mean, it's just been, and they're desperate. They're really desperate now because they can't sell this. This is crazy. But Medicare Advantage is one of the worst things that could possibly happen to us. And so since they can't sell it, they got this fake guy who's supposedly a negotiator. His name was Steinman, who said, I think it would be a good idea if we put everybody on Medicare Advantage. And if they refuse to go, we're going to take away their health care on the people who are on the payroll. And so then Milgrew, who's the head of the UFT, said, you see this guy, he says it's a really good idea and he's a negotiator, but he's nobody. Nobody asked this guy. Nobody hired this guy. He just made the statement and pretended that he had some authority.
And the AFT, Mulgrew's head of the United Federation of Teachers, AFSCME, these unions have been going along with the Democrats, with Biden and the Democrats, who have been privatizing Medicare. Isn't that the case? I mean, they haven't been fighting nationally for single payer to take away the control of the healthcare industry from these billionaires, from the private capitalists who really are profiting from healthcare.
Well, they're opposed to single payer. As a matter of fact, whenever it came up in the state assembly, Mulgrew sent a message to the politicians, do not even bring this up for a vote. And Randy Weingarten, who's the head of the AFT and UFT is part of that, basically at the Democratic National Convention opposed the idea of single payer and said that we do better with private health insurance as opposed to with having national, you know, single payer.
And I understand some of these officials are actually on these insurance boards. actually getting money from the insurance companies.
There's the guy who's the head of the Teamsters Union. I forget his name right now. He's on the board of Emblem. And so, I mean, all of these people are such lowlifes. My union, my other union, the Professional Staff Congress, which is supposed to be the, you know, the radical union, was negotiating for 3 years without telling anybody. And so now that it all came out, the new president, President Davis, he voted against the deal. But, you know, PSC has 30,000 people and UFT has 125,000 people. He could walk away looking like a saint. And now he's putting forward some incredibly convoluted, we should have this kind of insurance, that kind. It was too convoluted really to decipher, rather than saying we need single payer.
And what can be done? I mean, the contracts are up, and that's the case around the country, public workers in San Francisco, public workers all over the country. It seems like these union leaders who have been supporting the Democratic politicians don't really want to go after the billionaires who are in these cities. New York is one of the richest cities in the world, the wealthy. Yeah,
we have like 112 or more billionaires in New York alone. So taxing the rich is just not even a question. They're coming up with all kinds of savings. The hospitals shouldn't charge so much. They shouldn't overcharge. That the drug company shouldn't overcharge. But to talk about taking the money from the rich is just, it doesn't even formulate in their discussions at all. Right now, the major retiree groups will be down at City Hall on Monday because there's going to be testimony. And on the 19th, there's going to be a vote. And basically, as sincere as many of these retirees are, they're basically trying to court the Democratic Party in the city council, explaining to them why they should be nice to us and explaining to us that they don't really understand what they're doing. And so we have to explain to them, because they don't get it, how bad this will be for us. And it'll be devastating. Many, many old folks will die because of it. There's no doubt in my mind. But to have this enduring belief in the Democratic Party is really completely sort of incredible now, when the Democratic Party is basically going to start. Adams is our mayor. He's a Democrat. He's leading the charge against Medicare and trying to push us into Medicare Advantage. The governor, the same. I mean, they're all Democrats in this. This is a Democratic city.
And he's been supported by the unions.
The TWU went out wholeheartedly for Adams. And Adams is so, he was a cop. He's so bad that there was a young girl of 14 years old in Staten Island who was choked by a cop. And his response was, not that this is so horrible, but he said, I don't think that the population will lose their confidence in the police department. He's a guy with a heart.
Okay, well, thank you for joining us, Carol.
That was a report on the attack of New York City public retirees who face massive price increases on their health care from Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
People moving out, people moving in. Why? Because of the color of the skin. Run, 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 but you sure can't hide. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Vote for me and I'll set you free. Rap on, brother, rap on. Well, the only person talking about love and brother is the preacher. And it seems nobody's interested in learning but the teacher. Segregation, determination, demonstration, integration.
A classic by The Temptations, Ball of Confusion. That's what the world is today. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. The Electronic Intifada is an independent news outlet dedicated to the Palestinian struggle for self-determination. Host of the Electronic Intifada podcast, Nora Burroughs Friedman and Asa Winstanley, were recently joined by Executive Director Ali Abunima to talk about some of the top stories of 2022, including Israel's escalating violence against Palestinians, the rise to power of the extreme far right, the resurgence of Palestinian resistance and global solidarity, including Israel's escalating violence against Palestinians, the rise to power of the extreme far right, the resurgence of Palestinian resistance and global solidarity, Israel's murder of Al Jazeera's journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, the state of journalism and ongoing Western complicity in Israel's apartheid system. Here is part of their conversation.
Let's start by talking about the unmitigated violence that Israel has inflicted on Palestinians over the last 12 months. Around 200 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces and settlers so far this year or have died from injuries sustained in previous years. And just some statistics from our recent reporting, at least 34 Palestinian children have been killed by Israeli forces or settlers in the West Bank so far this year. Additionally, 17 Palestinian children were killed during Israel's three-day offensive in the Gaza Strip in August. At least 9 of them were killed in Israeli strikes, and others were killed by rockets fired by armed groups in Gaza or in ambiguous circumstances. We also saw the execution of Palestinian journalists, most notoriously the murder of Palestinian-American Al Jazeera reporter Shireen Abu Akleh in May. And the U.S. State Department continues to dismiss and ignore forensic evidence that an Israeli sniper intentionally murdered her. Ali, we saw the killing or injuring of Palestinians nearly every day this year, including during the August attacks on Gaza, and the political fueling of this violence by Israel's fascist government officials. Can you talk about Israel's sweeping policies of violence in 2022 and what stands out to you when we look back over this year?
It seems like it's almost a daily ritual to wake up and see the names and faces of the Palestinians who've been killed overnight, as it is overnight for us sitting, as I am in the US, in towns, villages, refugee camps, cities across Palestine. And this year, Israel killed more Palestinians in the West Bank this year since at least 2005. That's when OCHA, the UN agency, UN humanitarian agency, started keeping these statistics. And that includes more than 50 children, as you noted, Nora. This violence is escalating because it's a direct consequence of Israel's continued theft and expansion on Palestinian land. Settler colonialism is an inherently violent process. And So there's no such thing as Israeli settlements, Israeli colonization, Israeli dominance of the Palestinians without this brutal violence. And at the same time that the violence has been escalating, it seems that Western governments and Arab governments, who are generally client regimes of the West, are also escalating their rewards for Israel. So there is not there are individual Israelis who perpetrate these killings, or for the Israeli state and its leaders, they can carry on with killing as usual.
There's been a lot of focus over the last month or so about the new Israeli government officials and, you know, a lot of hand-wringing. Oh, this is the, you know, the most extreme government, you know, we've ever seen. But as you've been saying, you know, this is just a continuation. I think Last year, you said something like it's a different executioner, but the same axe. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of Itamar Ben-Gvir and the formation of this new Israeli government?
Right. As we're speaking, Nora, Benjamin Netanyahu is putting the finishing touches, so to speak, to his new coalition. And as I think viewers and listeners will know, it's going to include Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, the two leaders of this party called Jewish Power or Jewish Strength, depending on how you translate it. And who are these people? Well, Itamar Ben-Gvir is notorious as an inciter of violence against Palestinians. He's a settler. He's often in Hebron, where some of the most violent and extreme settlers are. And I think for me, the most indelible image of Itamar Ben-Gvir is from when he was younger. There's Israeli television footage of him in 1995, dressed up for Purim as Baruch Goldstein. Who is Baruch Goldstein? He is the American Jewish settler from Brooklyn who, on February 25th of 1994, on the third Friday of Ramadan, went into the Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron and machine gunned to death the 29 Palestinian men and boys as they were praying. And a year later on Purim, Itamar Ben-Gvir dressed up as Baruch Goldstein, this mass killer, and said on Israeli national television, "He's my hero." Now, if you think that was just some kind of youthful foolishness on behalf of Ben-Gvir, that's not at all the case. As recently as 2019, he bragged about keeping a portrait of Baruch Goldstein, the mass murderer, on his living room wall. And he continues to directly incite violence against Palestinians. As recently as October, he showed up in occupied East Jerusalem as settlers were attacking Palestinians, and Palestinians in their neighborhoods and refugee camps were, you know, exercising their right to protest, to fight back. Ben-Gvir showed up brandishing a pistol and urging settlers, if Palestinians throw stones, shoot them, just, you know, shoot them in the street, like, you know, the same tactics of British colonialists in South Africa or India or French colonialists in Algeria. But this is 2022. And Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who is no different, I mean, these are cut from the same cloth, are slated for top so-called national security posts in Netanyahu's government. So, of course, this is causing a lot of hand-wringing, particularly among sort of liberal Zionist Israel lobby groups in Britain and in the United States and other countries, because, you know, they're saying, oh, Ben-Gvir is a step too far. Israel's lovely, precious democracy is being threatened by ogres like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. But the reality is, the violence and the hatred and the incitement of Ben-Gvir and Smotrich has always been Israeli government policy and practice. I mean, the people who carried out the massacres in Deir Yassin and Tantura in 1948 were not any different from Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. The difference now is that Israel has discovered that it will enjoy unconditional support no matter what it does. I'm kind of reminded of when Donald Trump famously said, you know, I could shoot someone dead in the middle of Fifth Avenue and it wouldn't affect my popularity. And he was right for at least a very long time. And Israel is really, it's the Donald Trump of nations in that sense. Israel can do whatever it wants to Palestinians. And U.S. politicians, particularly top Democrats, of course, Republicans, but top Democrats and British politicians, whether it's Keir Starmer, who leads the Labour Party, I'm sure we'll talk about that, European Union leaders, whoever it is, the leaders of the United Arab Emirates Ben-Gvir was warmly welcomed at the United Arab Emirates Embassy in Tel Aviv recently. There are photos of the ambassador there warmly greeting him. So Israel's discovered it can do what it wants, and the unconditional support from governments will continue. So why disguise it? Why not put somebody who has a loving portrait of Baruch Goldstein on his living room wall in charge of national security? From Israel's perspective, there's no downside.
Right.
That was Ali Abu Nima, executive director of the Electronic Intifada. To hear the rest of the conversation, visit electronicintifada.net. Gil Scott-Heron, Must Be Something We Can Do. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. One of the worst humanitarian crises in the world is in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where more than 26 years of invasion and war have driven 5.5 million people into internally displaced persons camps and more than 1 million refugees into neighboring countries. Pacifica's Anne Garrison has more.
The aggression of Rwanda's M23 militia continues in the Democratic Republic of the Congo's resource-rich North Kivu province. It was reported today that the United Nations Organization Stabilization Mission in the DRC, also known as MONUSCO, has launched a new operation to protect civilians in the province. During the final days of 2022, Friends of the Congo held a 6-hour online vigil for peace in Congo, during which they played parts of the film Crisis in the Congo.
Congo is like a nightmare in heaven. It's a heaven because, you know, Congo is the heart of Africa. So much natural resources, the people, the animals, the flowers, everything, you know. Congo is heaven, but the thing is that people are living like in hell. People are dying. At first, we used to hear 1 million people die, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the situation is getting worse and worse, you know, because the money is there, the resources are out there in Congo, and everybody wants a piece of Congo. Everybody wants a piece of Congo.
Why are people living hand-to-mouth in one of the most mineral-rich countries in the world? The Congo produces more than $1 billion of gold alone each year.
And the cobalt and the tin and the copper and the tungsten, all of that we're benefiting from, but yet we're silent.
When people invade your country, they rape your women, they rape the kids, they morally control your mind.
Are we gonna have to wait for 20 more years before somebody does something to stop this Holocaust?
There's a global consensus that exists that says it's okay for nearly 6 million black people to die in the heart of Africa and for us to be silent.
The story of Congo is often overlooked for its complexity. It's a story where boundaries are porous and national identities mean little. Militant groups with ever-changing acronyms are not who they claim to be, and neighbors loot and murder while they are praised by the international community. But the death toll is now surpassing that of the Holocaust, in part because of the way the United States is involved in Central Africa. now facing a critical juncture in their history. The Congolese people need us to change the way we're involved so that they can have the space to start rebuilding their country.
The first principle to understand about the Congo, the affairs of the Congo have not been determined by the people of the Congo. The national boundaries were formed at the Berlin Conference in 1885 when Congo was given to King Leopold II of Belgium as his own personal property.
He owned it for 23 years, and during that time made a huge fortune off the territory, estimated at well over $1 billion in today's American dollars, primarily from turning people into forced laborers to gather ivory and then even more so wild rubber.
As the Belgians were pursuing ivory and rubber, though, they discovered lots of gold deposits, diamonds, copper, cobalt, and many other minerals.
So, since 1885, Congo has been caught in the midst of a geostrategic battle, primarily for her natural resources.
Part of its ongoing conflict has been the desire by different armed groups and neighboring countries to benefit, to get rich, to make money from those particular minerals.
These resources that are found in the Congo are vital to major industries in the West, whether we're talking about the automotive industry, aerospace industry, technology industry, the electronics industry, even the jewelry industry.
These minerals exist in great profusion throughout the Democratic Republic of Congo, especially in its eastern part.
But all this 125 years must be taken into consideration to fully understand why Congo is in a weakened state today. If we look from 1885 to 1908, we're talking about personal rule, enslavement. From 1908 to 1960, colonialism, Congo under colonial rule. Congo finally elects its leader in 1960, and in 61 was assassinated. So we have assassination. Then a dictator was put over the people for another 3 decades. So now we have dictatorship. Then an invasion was backed from the outside with Rwanda and Uganda in 1996 that Congolese people suffer from to this day. So we have 125 years of this. Now what that does is it destroys and eviscerates the Congolese institutions.
And when you have great wealth, no government, it's an open invitation, and it's been a sort of a free-for-all war as rival warlords surrounding African countries like Rwanda and Uganda in the east have just gone in there and helped themselves to this enormous natural wealth.
Since 1996, the conflict in Congo has claimed the lives of an estimated 6 million people. Today, neighboring governments continue plundering by using proxy forces to displace entire communities for access to the land. Scenes like this are often misunderstood as simply the result of an ethnic war, a mistake that only benefits those trying to hide their illegal exploits.
It has nothing to do with ethnicity. They killed Congolese like they were flies. You see how people, you feel a mosquito and just hit? That's exactly how they killed. It did not mean anything to them how they were killing the Congolese, as long as we can just wipe them out and get access. I mean, the mines exist. People used to live in those areas. Have we ever asked who was living where the mine was before? Did the mine just show up? No, there were villages where those mines were.
From 1996 to the present, an estimated 6 million dead. Abject poverty. People living in bestial conditions. Hundreds of thousands of women systematically raped as a strategy of war.
Rape happened to be one of the weapon that worked the most, because as soon as you destabilize a community, you rape the entire village, the women of the entire village, in front of the children, in front of the husband, in front of the neighbors, that community is broken completely. Because the men cannot look at the wives in the eye and say, we were unable to protect you. And the women cannot survive that trauma.
That was audio from part of the film Crisis in the Congo, which was played during Friends of the Congo's end-of-year vigil for peace in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The violence of Rwanda's M23 militia in Congo continues to escalate. The U.S. and EU have urged Rwanda to stop, quote, supporting, unquote, M23, even though UN experts report that M23 is a Rwandan militia and that Rwandan defense forces are fighting alongside them. For Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
Lend ears to what I say. Famine is a current state. Signed and sealed is our fate. Doctrines often falling. Angel, no water. Quench eternal flames of hell. Hellfire. I said doctrines often falling. Angel, no water. Quench eternal flames of hell. Hellfire.
Earth Crises by Steel Pulse. Dr. Avsin Malhotra, a British cardiologist, had been a verbal proponent of the COVID-19 vaccines until the sudden death of his famous father right after receiving the Pfizer vaccine. Malhotra grew up in a family of doctors. His father was the first Asian to be elected as honorary vice president and deputy chair of the Council of the British Medical Association, which represents more than 150,000 doctors in the UK. After his father's tragic death, Dr. Malhotra started his own research into the safety of COVID vaccines. In his recent peer-reviewed paper, he critically re-evaluates the true benefits and potential harms of the COVID shots. Russell Brand spoke with him on his show.
A man who is a doctor, a cardiologist, a public health campaigner, Dr. Avsin Malhotra. You've recently released a paper. What is it that's been revealed through your papers?
So, Russell, these are two papers published in the International Journal of Insulin Resistance, peer-reviewed. Essentially, I spent about 9 months critically appraising the data on the mRNA vaccine, specifically Pfizer's vaccine, to look at the benefit and harms and what the implications were from those results in terms of how we move forward in the management of COVID-19. And to conclude, essentially, what I found is that, which is not news for many people, there was a clear lack of informed consent when it came to the administration of the vaccine. But when one breaks down the data, certainly now you have to vaccinate several thousand people to prevent one COVID death, and that's likely best case scenario. But the absolute risk of harm is actually unprecedented in the history of medicine. So we're talking about harms of at least 1 in 800 to 1 in 1,000 of a serious adverse event occurring. Now, what that means is, Russell, I think anyone looking at that data, which for me is unequivocal, it suggests, and what I concluded from my paper, that the COVID mRNA vaccines need to be suspended, paused, or whatever you want to say, withdrawn, until a full investigation is launched into Pfizer's original trial, getting access to the raw data, and also analyzing properly what we call pharmacovigilance data, so real-world data around the reporting of adverse events, which I've said already is unprecedented.
Can you tell me how big a sample size you're talking about? Like, what underwrites these claims?
Well, when in evidence-based medicine, when you look at data, you have to look at the quality of the study. So if we start first and foremost, I'm glad it's already been mentioned a few times. If you go back to Pfizer's original trial, there was a reanalysis done by independent researchers, very eminent scientists from University of Stanford, Robert Kaplan, associate editor of BMJ, Peter Doshi, and Joseph Freeman, who's a lead author who I've spoken to directly on his findings. And they looked into the original trials of Moderna and Pfizer. And by the way, Russell, why this is important is this is what we call the gold standard of evidence-based medicine, randomized controlled trials. It was these studies alone that led to the rollout of the vaccine, the approval of the vaccine, and even the coercion and mandates for the vaccine. So what those original findings concluded independently, which is what I'm about to tell you, is crucial to the whole narrative now as we move forward. And they found, and this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Vaccine, one of the premier vaccine journals in the world, only a few weeks ago. For me, it's a smoking gun. They found that the original trial suggested that one was more likely to suffer a serious adverse event from taking the vaccine than one was to be hospitalized with COVID. And this is also during the original Wuhan strain, if you remember, Russell, which was far more lethal. So it suggests certainly quite strongly that even at the beginning, it was likely that the vaccine was going to do more harm than good for most people. And I find it very hard to believe that the Pfizer scientists didn't know that. And it may well be that's why Pfizer was so keen to get indemnification across the world from several governments against being liable for vaccine injury. And the biggest sort of largest democracy country in the world, if you like, actually said no, and that was India. India refused for that indemnification because they thought, well, if there are going to be serious vaccine injuries, the government is then going to be liable. And that's really the situation we're in. So as far as quality of data is concerned, it's the highest quality data. And given that risk of serious adverse events, which is likely at least one in 800, then for me, it's a no-brainer. It needs to be paused and it needs to be an investigation immediately.
It seems to me, Doctor, that to admit a transgression on this scale would be so disruptive, so expensive, such a sort of a dissolution of the assumptions that we lived with for that 2-year period, that it's kind of an insurmountable barrier, really. Do you not feel that ultimately what will happen is that you'll be marginalised and maligned and these findings will be buried? You can't admit this. It's too heavy, isn't it?
No, it's a great point, Russell. So I thought about this in a lot of depth even before I published this. But the reality is this, for me personally, first and foremost, I cannot continue in my good conscience as a doctor, as a public health campaigner, without exposing this truth. And Russell, this isn't an anomaly. This is not an anomaly. I for the last sort of 10 years, have campaigned on increasing transparency in medicine. And on 3 occasions, Russell, I've even called for a public inquiry through different media outlets, The Guardian, The Daily Mail, The Eye, saying that we need an inquiry into the pharmaceutical industry and how research is disseminated.
What are the next steps that we can take? Are you saying that people should, obviously you're saying no one should get any more COVID boosters and that it's the role of the media now to start publicising this new data? Do you think that there's any chance of the kind of transparency that's required?
Russell, I think there is. And of course, part of it is through social media and the dissemination of knowledge to the masses. I've seen a huge change. The papers were published a couple of weeks ago in the Journal of Insulin Resistance. It's open access, it's free. I've had amazing feedback, phenomenal feedback from doctors. I've had no serious rebuttals to the paper. There've been a few blogs, a few character assassination type of stuff, but they're not addressing the main concerns. No one is rebutting any of the clear facts. And certainly, as a cardiologist, the reason I looked at this in the first place is one of the most common side effects or concerns of the mRNA vaccines are cardiovascular myocarditis, cardiac arrest, heart attacks. And the data that suggests that is very, very good quality data. So for me, the way we move forward is through this continued dissemination for the public to become aware. But I'm not somebody that is just going to, write a paper and then sit back. You know, I will push this and campaign on this issue as long as I can. In fact, I'm actually speaking the British Parliament to MPs to actually present data to MPs to say the conclusions are very clear. We need to suspend the vaccine. Now, one thing I know people should be reassured, even Joe Biden said the pandemic is over. Omicron that's circulating now is no worse than a bad cold or the flu. So if there's a time to pause the vaccine, it's now. People should be reassured by it.
That was Dr. Asim Malhotra in conversation with Russell Brand. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all the Pacifica sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at Pacifica CRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.